talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So what an honor it is to be here speaking about the universal persona of the first divinely appointed Imam, the living, breathing miracle of Islam, the champion of the great battles of Islam, Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, you know, we find when we're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, one of the very integral and very beautiful features of His Eminence is the intense love that Imam Ali alayhi salam had for the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Now, this might seem like a trivial thing, but we find that the Holy Quran and the traditions of the infallibles, including the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, it has a great emphasis on the love for the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And of course, at the head of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And so we find that even in the Holy Quran, when the people wanted to reward the Holy Prophet, the Holy Prophet responded with the verse of the Holy Quran that the only reward that I want is for you to have this deep love and this intense love for my Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. Now, when we look at the statements of Imam Ali, His Eminence really showed via his personality, his words, his behaviors, that he truly loved the Messenger of Allah. At one point, somebody asked Imam Ali alayhi salam how much he loved the Holy Prophet. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam, he swears by the Almighty Allah. He does this religious fiqhi jurisprudential oath. And of course, as many of you know, this jurisprudential oath or swearing in the name of the Almighty Allah is not something that you can break. It is haram and forbidden to break. So Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, by Allah, I swear this. The Prophet is dearer to us than our fortunes, our sons, and our mothers. He is even dearer to us than cold water to the thirsty. And so we find that this is just one statement of the many statements that His Eminence made about his intense love for the Holy Prophet. Whenever the Holy Prophet wanted to stand up, Imam Ali alayhi salam used to help him to stand up. Whenever the Holy Prophet wanted to sit down, he would lean on Imam Ali. We find that whenever there was something that the Holy Prophet wanted to do, Imam Ali was always at the forefront of helping him to do that. And so this love of the Ahlul Bayt, this love for Imam Ali alayhi salam, this love for the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, is something that is really integral in the persona of the first divinely appointed Imam. And it is something that can take you to spiritual excellencies and spiritual heights. Merely following and obeying the orders, yes, that is the first step of this ladder. But, you know, merely obeying without any love being involved, you know, to the one that you're obeying, it's not going to really get you to spiritual heights and excellencies. And of course, when you learn about these infallibles and immaculates, peace and blessings upon them all, it is really, you know, there's nothing much you can do other than to fall in love with them. A beautiful lesson indeed brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إِنَّكَ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
This is a khutbah that Ali gave after he was accepted as the Khalifa of the Muslims. And so he ends this part by saying, وَلَهُمْ خَصَائِصُ حَقِّ الْوِلَايَةِ وَفِيهِمِ الْوَصِيَّةِ وَالْوِرَاسَةِ. Ali Muhammad possessed the special qualities for authority, the wilayat over the ummah. And they have, in their favor exist, the will and the succession of the Prophet. On no one else is that. And they're referring to his own Khilafat. At that time, he says, Al-an is raja al-haq ila ahlihi. Now the right, the haq, the truth has returned to its rightful owner. Where it was before, it wasn't in the hands of the rightful owner. And this is where we see, you know, the importance of Amir al-Mu'mineen when he talks about Ahlul Bayt. You know, these are not the issues of those who are ghali, exaggerating the position of Ali Muhammad. Amir al-Mu'mineen, one of the beauties of him which transcends time and space is his quality of ilm and his insistence on justice. When you look at his adl and justice, a Christian writer from Lebanon talks about the life of Ali, and the title of the book says quite a lot. Ali, the voice of human justice. For him, Ali becomes the voice of human justice. And he was so much particular about this issue. Actually, there is a saying among historians where they say, قُتِلَ فِي الْمَحْرَابِ لِشِدَّةِ عَدْلِهِ. Ali was killed in the mihrab, and the purpose, the motivation behind his murder was his insistence, his shiddat on the matters of justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Nazia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Israeli regime continues to cause death and destruction in the region. On Saturday alone, 20 more Palestinians were killed and almost 90 others injured in Gaza. And on Sunday, the regime attacked the southern part of Beirut and Dahiyeh and killed 5 people and wounded 28 others, including 10 children and 8 women. Both in Gaza and Lebanon, the Zionist entity has ceasefire agreements. Well, while these agreements have guarantors, they simply look the other way as the agreements continue to be violated on an almost daily basis in both places. So what is the meaning of an agreement for the regime and its Western backers? And what is next for the region? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ali Hani, military strategic affairs analyst out of Beirut. Saad Nimr, professor of political science, Beirut University, out of Ramallah. Thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Beirut. And Ali, I mean, since November of 2024, when Lebanon and the regime agreed to a ceasefire, many Lebanese have been killed by the Zionists. I mean, does the regime actually think that it can destroy the resistance with such attacks? Or what is behind this, in your perspective?
Greetings to you and to your guest and all the audience. Let's say that the 1701 agreement and the 20 points deal of Sharm el-Sheikh regarding Gaza, both agreements are gone with the wind because the Israelis does not recognize such announcement or agreement, and they still violate them. Let's take Lebanon now. Since 27/11/2024, about a year exactly, up to now, about 10,000 violation against Lebanon, 335 killed, and more than 900 injured in Lebanon because of the Israelis' aggression against Lebanon. And what's amazing in this situation, that who is supposed to be the guarantor on mechanism committee to implement, to control the implementation and to observe the implementation of 1701 resolution, which is announcement of cessation of hostilities between Lebanon and the Israeli entity, is the same. This guarantor is the same who always given the green light to the Israelis to have aggressions against Lebanon. So I think the head of this committee, who is within, he's working within the UNIFIL forces in Lebanon, he is given the permission to the Israelis to attack Lebanon from time to time, at any time they need it, to kill as so-called, you know, a golden goal or golden target for the Israelis to kill in Lebanon or to commit assassination.
Mm-hmm.
So I think General Clearfield, the head of this mechanism, is only controlling Lebanon not to have even a word against the Israelis. We have Rodolf Haykel, the army commander, Lebanese army commander, once said that the Israeli enemy, they make a big issue out of it, and that Lebanon should not call Israel as an enemy, but Israel attacking Lebanon, killing the innocent and the civilians, and destroying the infrastructure is okay with them.
Okay. Interesting points. I mean, Saeed, let's pick up on what Ali has just said about the guarantors of these agreements, actually, both whether we're talking about Gaza or we're talking about Lebanon. Your take, do you feel that the guarantors are actually in some ways allowing the Israeli regime, that the regime actually serve as its proxies because they're not saying anything, they're creating situations to allow this to continue to happen? I mean, how do you see that, Saad?
Good evening to you, Mrs. Hashimi, and to your guest from Beirut, and to all your viewers. Well, I think that Israel is trying now to implement a new kind of policy in the region, whether that is in Gaza or even in Lebanon, which allow them to take action whenever they wanted and to assassinate whoever they wanted and to bombard in any way they wanted. And this is coming today after 2 days of the president of Lebanon said that he's willing to start negotiating. And this is the answer from Israel, is to continue to do that. They are not interested. But I think that what they are interested in is to provoke Hezbollah in order to resume the war on Lebanon and to make sure that this time there will be a huge devastation, and that would help. Generally, they think so, that in this case, the people in Lebanon will say to Hezbollah, that's it, you have to put down your weapon. Like the same situation, more or less, is in Gaza. In Gaza also, they are trying now to provoke the Palestinians, and in order to, because of the what they've been doing in the last just month and a week after the signing of the ceasefire, more than 370 Palestinians were killed. So this number is very, very high in comparison, and remind us with the days before the ceasefire itself. So they are resuming war here and there, and they want to implement this new rules in the area that they have, in spite of the ceasefire agreement in both areas, in Lebanon and in Palestine. They are saying that we are committed to, but in spite of this agreement, they continue with these atrocities, and they consider it as something from their point of view, and agreed with America also, mm-hmm. That it is allowed to Israel to do so. This kind of the understandings between Israel and the United States, that they are will be allowed to continue, you know, bombardment here and there and assassination here and there when it is necessary from their point of view. And because of that, they are continuing to do that. And this is the policy that they want to implement in the area, in spite of the ceasefire agreements, which was guaranteed in both sides with the countries and United States itself and other countries around.
Well, Andy, in your perspective, what is Israel's ultimate goal with these attacks in Lebanon? I mean, is it an intimidation type of project to make sure that Hezbollah never responds, to put fear in the people, to try to put pressure? Is it to eliminate Hezbollah? I mean, how do you see it, the regime's ultimate goal right now with these attacks that's almost happening on a daily basis now?
You know, before I go for explanation, let's say it briefly. It is a war of pressure for to subjugate the Lebanese negotiators in case they want to go into the negotiation table, which I believe now it's not anymore in the Israeli interest to have any negotiation with Lebanon, as long as most of the Arab countries are going for normalization or for Abraham Accord. Syria is totally dismantled, divided into now there are five Syrias. Maybe in another couple months it will be tens or 15 Syrias. I'm talking about Syria 1, Syria 2, Syria 3. So that's what Israel is aiming at. They don't care anymore about any negotiation with Lebanon because they believe they can use their tools in any way, from anywhere, and they are using up to now, not military, but they are using the whole Arab media. I'm talking about the countries that are under the Abraham Accord or under the normalization, even though they didn't declare it, but they are into it. All the media are against Hezbollah, against Hamas, against the resistance, against the Palestinian cause, against Palestine itself. They don't want to take on their shoulder anymore and carry the Palestinian cause to retrieve the occupied land to the Palestinian. And some of them are coming now on TVs, and especially on Al Arabiya, to say that this land, to say that this land belongs to the Jews and not to the Palestinians historically, and they're trying to kill with the with their help. They're trying to kill the truth. Also, the truth. Also, they want to kill the geography and the history of the region. So the only two unswallowable big bites in the region still, I'm not talking about Iran or Pakistan or Turkey, I'm talking about the surrounding countries. We are talking about Hamas, especially Hamas in Gaza, or let's say especially Gaza, not the whole area, because the Palestinian Authority are in their pocket right now, in the Israeli pocket, and they are some kind of puppies or muppets. So the only two unswallowable bites in the region are Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas in Gaza. So they want to use their most powerful tools inside or outside, through the Arab world or through the determination of every country to go along with, I'm talking about Abraham Accord.
Okay.
So in this case, we'll have fire heating the fire and some kind of corrosion inside each country. And this is in Lebanon and Gaza up to now. We still can resist such way of pressure and subjugation.
Okay. Well, Saad, I mean, today, as you know, the capital, Beirut, Dahiya, was targeted, heavily populated residential area. Do you think the Zionist regime has decided that it wants to enter a full-scale war with Lebanon and the resistance, or how do you see it?
Oh, yeah, yes, absolutely, but under conditions. I think that the Israelis are not going to enter Lebanon or to occupy parts of Lebanon on the ground war, but rather they will use their air force and the bombardment. That's how it is. They put Hezbollah, however, in a very awkward situation after today's assassination. Either Hezbollah will retaliate, and in this case, Israelis are preparing for a massive attack on Lebanon and to resume the war, even if, as they said, for a few days maybe, but still, they are going to use their air force and their bombardments to make, you know, to inflict this kind of a huge destruction in Lebanon in order to make people, you know, go against Hezbollah. And on the, if Hezbollah did not retaliate, it means that Israel now have the upper hand to do whatever they want in Lebanon, whenever they want, regardless if there is a kind of negotiations or not regarding the ceasefire and the withdrawal of the Israeli troops from Lebanon. So I think that what happened today is very, very, you know, important kind of a milestone in the relationship in the region. And for Hezbollah in particular, Hezbollah till now did not even announce what's going to happen. They are waiting even to announce about the assassination officially. And after that, they said, we will study the situation. They are in a very, you know, awkward situation. If they retaliated, it means that Israel is preparing a massive attack on Lebanon and a huge destruction without even entering the borders of Israel, apart from the areas that they are in today. But if Hezbollah did not retaliate, it means that, okay, Israel will get it, that Hezbollah is weaker now, and they can't do anything about it, and we can do whatever we want in Lebanon whenever we want. That's the problem that Israel is creating now in Lebanon.
Your thoughts, Ali. I mean, what are Hezbollah's options right now? How do you think that it will respond to what has taken place today?
Well, let's see first who is the number one enemy and who is the agitator of such war against Lebanon. We all remember the massacre of the Pagers in Lebanon. It was American hand, totally American hands behind it, not the Israelis. And we all know that gospel system that been introduced to the 8,200 unit in Israel to penetrate Hezbollah through the electronic warfare, not the cyber warfare. And now we know that for a month right now, for a month, we all know, and we talked about it on the news, that the MQ-4, MQ-9, U-2, and Compass Call, and they are all intelligence, observer, surveillance, multi-role, UAVs and drones, American. I'm talking about American. And we can see that they gather all the information to give it to the Israelis after the Israelis went over Lebanon with the Squadron 122, and this is equal to AWACS airplanes, and they could not find any new target in Lebanon. Now we see that the Israeli failed again against Lebanon intelligence-wise, but the American helped them again and again. And I heard it today, the Speaker of the White House said that most of the information in the hand of Israel are coming from the United States. So
right
now our war is not against Israel, is against United States, and in this case against the NATO, against the Western Hemisphere. So how to retaliate Hezbollah, how can be able to retaliate? It should be very carefully studied, and it should be maybe starting liberating the 5 points in Lebanon occupied by the Israelis, or starting shutting down the drones.
Okay. Well, Saad, what about that, what Ali has just said? I mean, it's really not about the Israeli regime alone, and it has never really been. But it has been the whole Western hegemonic front, whether we're talking about Gaza or whether we're talking about Lebanon. I mean, isn't this the reality that the resistance in general is facing? And what does it mean, as Ali said, that an American official openly admits their involvement? And we know that Trump, many different times, and what he has said about the U.S. involvement in Gaza and then not being involved, contradicting himself. I mean, your thoughts.
Oh, yes, absolutely. We know that. And that's why the now in the international community, if you like, it should be a kind of a new kind of set in the world. We are talking about China and Russia, India, and some of the South American countries, some African countries. Now, I think it's part of the whole thing, and this is one could be of the last battles for the Western atmosphere against the East and South. I hope that will be. Because now I think things are quite clear. We rely on the people in Europe and in America to rise again, because now it became obvious after ceasefire and after doing all that, Israel is continuing its atrocities against these people. That will make it clear that this country is a country that threatened the whole peace in the whole area, and it is not Hezbollah or Hamas or others who are trying to liberate their countries from such aggression and from such occupation. So we had to focus on this now more than any other time among the people who are standing and used to stand with whether Lebanon or Palestine in all of the Western Hemisphere. At the same time, it's a call for really those Arab and Islamic countries now to start thinking about their relationship and their even economic relationship as well with which countries, and to sign and to be with the side of the other countries like China.
But let me just jump in here, Saad. You're talking about the Arab countries, but we've also been talking about the number of more and more Arab countries that seem as if they want to be part of the Abraham Accords instead of supporting the oppressed of the region. So where does that leave us? Let me throw this back to Ali. So, Ali, with what you're saying, that it's all of NATO, or as I call it, the whole Western hegemonic front, that is actually, whether we're talking about Lebanon and many would say even Gaza, that it's a battle of the whole front. Do you think that in response to what is happening, let's say the increased attacks now on Lebanon, that it's going to take the whole resistance front together to counter the whole hegemonic front? I mean, how do you see where this is going at this point in time?
I think this is one of the options, to gather all the resistance ally front against the Israelis, the American, the state of normalization in the region, and also in the Western countries. But the problem is we have no confidence in our neighbors along, because what happened during the aggression and the genocide against Gaza, all the Arab countries surrounding, and especially the Abraham Accord countries and the state of normalization, they helped Israel not only by supporting the entity with food and with medicine, with oil. About 233 shipments of oil went to Israel from Saudi Arabia and Emirates and Azerbaijan. But also they support Israel by sending a full army. I'm talking about full brigades, of army brigades, and especially to attack Example, the United Arab Emirates, they attack Gaza by air raids. So what we can say, what we can do, I think now it's time to wait and to check if we can go back strategically and when what's going on strategically, because on the ground, most of the countries are swimming in the American Sea, and they cannot do anything wrong because the United States will sink them. So in this right now, I see that even though the Israelis and
30 seconds, I mean,
they are gaining. Even though the Israelis are gaining some points on the field and military-wise, but I think they are jumping into the unknown strategical-wise.
All right, and on that note, I think both of you being with me, Ali Hami, military and strategic affairs analyst out of Beirut, Saad Nemra, professor of political science, Beirut University out of Ramallah. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Shines above. You're the reason I never give up. You're the one I try for. Live my life for. Give up all I have. You're the melody, you're the key, all the inspiration I need. And when times get tough, I know you'll stand by me. You are the love I need, the one who is God. You know my destiny, for you are the light, and you are my life. Oh, 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 oh. And you know my destiny.
good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Then it's time for Around the World with Reporters. Listen to fascinating reports from all over the globe as reporters tell us what is happening in their corner of the world. Our radio productions feature will again follow after this. Stay with us for this hour.
Hello and welcome to Attrition. I'm your host, Amar Ghazmi, and in this show we delve into the forces of war, imperialism and Zionism, exploring their impact on our world and what it will take to overcome them. Today it's a privilege to be joined by Sarah Wilkinson. Sarah is a British independent journalist and a long-standing campaigner for Palestinian liberation. She began her professional career as a graphic designer and illustrator before transitioning into the world of journalism, where she's become known as one of the few Western voices providing unfiltered coverage of the situation on the ground in Palestine. Because of that, Sarah has been targeted by the Israel lobby, and in August 2024, she became the latest British journalist to be targeted for arrest. Her house was raided by the police and she was arrested under the Terrorism Act. She had her devices seized and was denied vital medication while in custody. And since then, she's been living under strict bail conditions that effectively aim to gag her work. Although she was able to join the recent global Samud flotilla that aimed to break the blockade on Gaza before being arrested again upon her return to Britain. She currently awaits trial for terrorism charges that have been brought against her, which is scheduled to take place in January 2027. But despite the onslaught she faces, Sarah refuses to be silenced, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the show today. So Sarah, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Sarah, let's just start by looking at your story, because while you're a very important independent journalist now, in a previous life, you were doing something a bit different in graphic design and illustration. So how did you become a journalist, and what drew you to focus so deeply or more deeply on Palestine?
Oh, there's sort of two questions there. I mean, although I was a graphic designer, I was working with a newspaper, so which was pretty much pro-Palestinian. So my interest, if you like, in Palestine sort of like moved across, because it was already there. It was already there in the newspaper. So we ran a lot of pro-Palestinian stories in the early days. Some of them seem quite remote. I mean, we were covering the Ramallah tortoise, for instance, which not many people know about, the Palestinian indigenous tortoise that is being wiped out by the bulldozing of homes. So we were covering stories like that, water, conservation and things like that. But my interest in Palestine began years before that, when I discovered a leaflet in a library with a picture of a little boy facing into the barrel of an Israeli soldier's gun, and I couldn't understand it. I think he was about 10 years old. I think I was about 10 as well. So, you know, I took the leaflet, because this is the reference library. So I did take the leaflet with me, and I read it, and I didn't fully understand it. So that led to me then trying to understand what was going on there. How could a child the same age of me have so much courage that he could stare into the gun of an Israeli soldier, and why? And so, you know, the research in those days was quite difficult. A lot of the books that were in the Central Library were all about tourism. They didn't explain the Nakba. A lot of it was from the Israeli narrative. So it wasn't until I really got to college and I was introduced to other pro-Palestinian people that it really began. I went to Greenham Common. That was one of my first protests. So I started learning about how protest works, why it's important, what happens when you get arrested, why people are being arrested. And it started to make the whole Palestinian issue make sense. So I was talking to people who knew more than me, who understood it from a political standpoint, which is, that was the thing that was missing in those days. So when you've done something for so long, when you've read about something for so long, it becomes intertwined in your, I suppose, in your blood. I'm not quite sure whether the Palestinians would want me to say that I have Palestinian blood, but it becomes entwined with you yourself. Everything that you do revolves around Palestine, and you grow up revolving around that research. And so then you start to meet people and have pen friends, because it was before the days of Facebook and before the days of Twitter, certainly. So the Palestinians that I was talking to, I was doing so by letter, and I was being introduced to more and more people. Families with young children. And then Facebook came along, and suddenly I could actually see who these people were in real time. And I was able to talk to them. I was able to listen to their stories. So the connection was already there. And also, I will say, and I'll try not to make it sound horrible, but I also witnessed them being killed. So this is the first time, and it was many years ago, my pen friends hiding under their kitchen table were bombed, 2012, I think, and only the mother survived. Her six children were killed. And she talked about having to make the choice of whether she saved the baby or she saved her mother, because both were on the top floor of the building. And she saved her mother and was racked with this enormous guilt that the baby had died. But then even her mother also didn't survive. So she was the only remaining person. So those were my original pen friends. So that was the beginning. That was the introduction to, I have to do something here. I cannot help this woman. I'm geographically miles apart from her, but I have to do more than just read. I have to do more than just wave a flag and wear a t-shirt. I have to actually become more proactive. I have to save the next family. I have to do something. And also learning to live with the shock of losing my first pen friends, I suppose. They were my first loss. And from then on, I have lost many. It's never got easier, but they were my first greatest loss. And so there's always a place in your heart for people that are your friends. And then you want to find out why they died, what happened, what is needless, what can you do to solve the situation? So you become much more politically involved, and you start protesting properly. And you start understanding the story properly, and you start reading about the politics properly. So yeah, it grew, it expanded, if you like, much the same as the Greater Israel Project. But yeah, that's how it was for me.
Well, I mean, the Palestinian cause has the capacity to awaken the moral consciences of people. I think what you outlined will certainly resonate with a lot of people. I mean, certainly for me, it was a case of, as you say, you sort of have this knowledge, once you encounter the Palestinian question, you instinctively start to understand that this is an oppressive situation that should be overcome, that Palestinian liberation is something that's right and should be fought for. But then there's that gap between knowing something and then working out, well, what is your role in that process of liberation? But as we know, walking on this path for the liberation of Palestine often comes at personal sacrifice. We know that the sacrifices that we endure here in the West are trivial compared to what Palestinians face. But in terms of, campaigning here in the West, you can face quite severe consequences, not death necessarily, but your case is a case in point. I mean, the strength of the animus against you from the Israel lobby is no doubt motivated by how effective you've been at reporting on Palestine. So let's just get into that. I mean, in August 2024, your house was raided you were arrested and subjected to quite fierce repression. Now walk us through what happened to you on that day and sort of the immediate period afterwards.
Yeah, it should be included actually before I start on that, you know, when we began campaigning for Palestine, we did not know that the repression or the oppression was this is how it was going to be. We didn't know that we were going to be targeted or that we would be arrested. There was no indication that suddenly it was going to be criminalized. So, yeah, in August, I was woken up about 10 past 7 by 16 balaclavaed, I have to call them thugs, when there were some uniformed police trailing behind. But what you see come into your house is plain clothes. You can see black vans. The top end of town is closed off. The locals are terrorized because they don't know what's happening. They think it's some sort of gun raid. Some said they didn't know whether they should run away, duck, or film it. They actually didn't really know what it was. And they're in your house. They say they have a warrant, but they're not going to reveal it to you. So they're in your house before you have a chance, really, to know that you should actually be shutting your door at this point and demanding a warrant. They're in already. I mean, there isn't the time. And you're pushed against the wall. And my son was pushed up against the wall. My house was absolutely ransacked. They were very clever. You know, they filmed it looking as if it was okay. And then most of the damage was probably done after they turned the cameras off. They hid things in places. They looted. They took things. They didn't list items. My son was thrown out of the house. I mean, he's just in his boxer shorts. So, you know, he then rang his dad, who came to support him and obviously probably bring some clothes as well. And, you know, they tore the house apart. And in doing so, you know, my mother's ashes were scattered all over. I live, my bedroom's actually an attic room, so it's spread all over the attic. And we still haven't managed to recoup all of her remains. There's a quarter of her remains missing. And to have to use a dustpan and brush to sweep up your mother's remains, that's going to stay with me for a long time. That was quite hideous. The fact that, you know, they didn't really care how much damage they caused. I mean, clothes, underwear, everything pulled out everywhere. And then they made some attempt to shove things back in the wrong drawer or the wrong wardrobe. And then, of course, as soon as they left, everything fell out on the floor anyway. So it's an absolute hideous mess. But items like my passport, these things weren't listed on, these are the items we've taken from your house list. So when they asked my son to sign that everything was in order, he just wanted them to go. They'd been there for hours. I think this was like 5 o'clock. He just wanted them to go. My son doesn't really know where my passport is or where I've kept cash or where some of my, you know, jewellery is. He doesn't know really what's missing. And why would he? Because he doesn't live here. He's just a guest. So, yeah, he signed it mainly to get rid of them. But because he signed the form, it is now very difficult to actually try and get any of these items back. I'm certainly not going to get my electronic devices back. They took other people's devices as well. They weren't all mine. And then wanted PIN numbers for devices that I don't own. So they took an awful lot of stuff, probably about £7,000 worth of equipment, if you add the mics and the headphones and you know, charger cables. And in fact, all of the cables, I've got lights on the stairs. Why do you need those cables? They're like one of those old fittings that you can never buy the cables for anymore. So it's just very malicious that like little items were taken, which kind of disabled the house from working properly. Bank cards missing, cash was taken, you know, everything that really decimated the house. And I don't know if they know what they were looking for. I think they were just looking for anything that they could pin on me. So there was this randomness about it. I don't, you know, they didn't find anything really. What they wanted was the devices. So they probably didn't need to destroy the house in the process. And it took us 7 days to put the house back together again, which is a long time. So,
well, I mean, what you've had to face is absolutely astounding and disgraceful and just so needless. And also, it's, as you said, it's sort of malicious and gratuitous, even the extent to which they have, you know, in the course of conducting this raid, damaged your house and, as you say, you know, scattered your mother's ashes. And it's really, really appalling. And also the effect, of course, then on, you know, someone like your son, completely, not that you're not innocent, but, you know, a completely sort of a third party to the whole situation, as I've been caught up in it, and absolutely no regard for him or his welfare. So it's just absolutely appalling. But of course, you know, you're one of many others who have been targeted. Perhaps the others haven't been targeted in quite the horrific way that you were, but we've seen Asa Winstanley, Richard Medhurst, Kit Clarenberg, others targeted. And that's just when we're talking about journalists, but we've also seen increasing crackdowns against activists, protesters, commentators, using brutal policing methods like you just outlined, and also quite intimidatory prosecutions. I mean, the situation is becoming quite severe now, isn't it?
It is, and what it is terrorism. It's terrorism against civilians, activists, reporters, doctors, teachers. And the elderly holding up placards. And I think there's been over 2,000 people arrested, and some of them very brutally. And every home raid has been a little bit different. It's like you'd almost think that there wasn't a pattern. I think that there is a pattern because there isn't a pattern. I think they're pushing out the boundaries. They're finding out how far they can go, who's going to take them to court, whether anybody's going to make an official complaint. You know, they're sort of testing the waters. So every home raid and every arrest has been a bit different. I've heard stories of an elderly woman left out in the snow in her nightgown for hours in bare feet while they searched her house and didn't allow her back in. So no compassion or even police protocol for, you know, taking people's age or their ability into account. So we've seen very young people being arrested very violently. So this almost is very close to sort of child abuse, when somebody very, very young, by 30 and 40-year-old police officers who are balaclavaed in much the same way, treating people with utter brutality. It's very, very close. And so there is no, well, it's done with total disregard for age, gender, ability, and celebrity status, if you like. It doesn't really matter. So it's an act of terrorism against us as civilians, and against activists. And it's done, this is the irony, it's done in the name of countering terror, of anti-terror. It's done in the name of combating crime. And certainly isn't combating crime arresting people that are innocent and have never committed any crimes. So, you know, when you're arresting an elderly person for holding up a placard, it's completely and utterly needless. And I think it is. It's British state terror. But they're using these anti-terror laws to commit this terrorism. And that is the irony of it, is these aren't terrorists. And these aren't people that would probably ever be, you know, ever do anything wrong. Well, they're very law-abiding citizens, if you like. You know, if they were actually going after people that were making threats, you know, threats of life against other people, then that would be one thing. But these are just ordinary folk, or they're ordinary students who've never been arrested before, or they're teachers, parents. You know, how long before they start arresting young children? Well, they probably are under Prevent. So, you know, it is terrorism, and they are using the anti-terror laws to commit their acts of terrorism. The irony is just astonishing, really.
Well, I mean, I wanted to actually consider this in a bit more detail, as you say, this sort of